Welcome to The Fast Track, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hi, and welcome to The Fast Track. I'm your host, Scott Benjamin, and I'm joined by Kurt Guerin, producer of the show as well, right, Kurt?
That's right.
You're doing double duty again, and hopefully for the long term, you're going to be doing double duty, because I think this is starting to work out. Yeah, we're getting kind of in our rhythm here and having some fun with it. So today, I think we've got a topic that both of us can, we'll probably have a lot to talk about, I think. There's 10 really unusual, unlikely, weird, strange, whatever you want to call them, race cars. There's been a list compiled by a place called drivingline.com, and they had an unusual one from others that I've seen, which I thought was intriguing. So I chose that one to kind of follow along with, and then I think we're going to add our own notes, because there's not a whole lot of material on each page. You know, it's kind of like one of those, it's like a slideshow almost, really, when you look at it online. And they go through and give you a little bit of information about it, just enough to kind of pique your interest. And that's exactly what they did with me. So, you know, I dug into each one of these a little bit deeper and know a little bit more about a couple of them anyway. So I thought it was worthwhile bringing this list to the show today, because they are unique and they are strange and wonderful and unusual, and you know, all of the you know, all the ways you can describe a race car that probably shouldn't be out there on the race course. And that's maybe the best way to put it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what did you, just real quick, when you saw this list that I sent over to you, anything really strike you as extraordinarily unusual? And you don't have to be specific, we'll talk about it when we get there, but is there anything that really stood out for you on this list?
Yeah, I mean, the look of a lot of the cars is unique. When I looked at it, I tried to take each one and look at the era in which it raced.
Yes.
And things began to make a lot more sense when you look at the cars in the landscape of racing at the time. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but there are some that actually make perfect sense. When you look at it, it looks a little funny, a little weird.
Yeah.
But then when you dive a little bit deeper, it definitely fits.
Could have been ahead of its time in some ways, right?
In some ways.
But other cars, when you look at it, you're like, I can't imagine at that time seeing that car on the racetrack.
Yeah.
It would be so unusual that it would be the one that would get all the attention, even if nothing really spectacular happened with it. Just the fact that it's on the track at any point in, you know, in that era, in that decade, or you know, whatever it happens to be, or in that series,
mm-hmm.
it makes it fascinating and unique in some ways. I do want to tell you that going through here, I came up with a couple of topics for shows in the future. Have you ever heard of anything called Roadkill Nights?
No.
Okay. Roadkill Nights is something that's relatively new. I think that this year might have been the second, possibly the third year of it. I'll have to dig into it again. It's something that happens in Pontiac, Michigan, in coordination with the Woodward Dream Cruise. It is a legal drag race that's held on the actual city streets. You know,
That's cool.
They block off the streets. They, you know, have the grandstand set up and everything, and it allows people to bring out whatever they've got. I think there's like a couple of categories. There's, I don't know if it's like small tire or I don't remember the two. There's like two classes, and that's it. It's like small tire and big tire, or it's wide tire and thin tire, something like that. I'm gonna dig into this, but some incredible street racing going on. One of the cars, one of these cars that I saw racing, I think it was a 55 Chevy, I believe. 3,200 horsepower. Unbelievable. And again, I'll dig into Roadkill Nights and I'll get all the facts right for anybody who's, you know, screaming and shaking their fist at the device right now saying, what an idiot. It's not, you know, thin tire, fat tire. But we'll get into that when we do the episode. The next thing that I want to mention is that this is held right near a place called the M1 Concourse. Now, M1, I believe, is Woodward Avenue, I think. Or is it Telegraph? I think it's Woodward Avenue. The M1 Concourse is like, imagine like a country club, but for car owners. And it's got a racetrack, a race circuit.
Mm-hmm.
It's got garages that you can rent. You know, like some of them are luxury, some of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
They have all different sizes. You know, you can just go in there. You can pull your car in there and work on it, store it, do whatever you want. It's the thing that you pay a membership for, and you belong to this club. And like, for instance, today, as we're recording this, and almost every day between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m., they have an open track session where you can go out and drive your race car or your, you know, your track day car or whatever you have,
mm-hmm.
or even your street car, I suppose. You can go and watch this. There's a performance school there. It's kind of like when I went to that Porsche driving experience
mm-hmm.
thing. It's like that, only you pay for a membership and you belong to this thing for, I don't know if it's a year or 6 months or whatever. But it's an interesting idea, and I know it's one that's kind of spread across the nation. I know that we've had other clubs like this where people, usually, not all the time, but usually it's people with a lot of money that want to bring a car that's not street legal and be able to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And they're able to park their car in their garage that, you know, is a bigger than my house, a 4,200 square foot garage that has a luxury loft and everything along with it, mm-hmm. and park one of their 5, 6, 7 cars below and then just use them at will or, you know, for these special events that they have. So it's a really cool idea, I think.
Yeah, it beats towing your race car to the track every time you want to drive it.
Yeah.
Just park it right there.
Yeah. And if you're not into golf, if you're not, you know, you don't want to swim and you don't want tennis and all that, you just want to belong to a club. You want to be able to use your vehicle that you can't use on normal city streets outside of the scarce weekend that you're able to get to an event. Like, mm-hmm. let's say you're an SCCA member or something and you have to tow it to the event and, you know, you have to bother with the trailer every time and all that.
It makes a lot of sense. You could set the car up the way you want it to be when you get it to the track. You don't have to drive it there. You can have your race tires on it and everything.
Perfect. You're right.
Pull it right out of the garage onto the track and go.
You're right. You just warm it up and go, right?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe a little bit of maintenance and probably a lot of, I would guess there's a lot of social activity around this as well. I would think that, you know, this is a tight-knit group of people, if I had to guess. Just because, you know, you kind of get kind of chummy with the people that are there, you know?
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, where else are you going to see some of these cars, you know, and to see them in action, which I think is really cool. I mean, outside of, you know, a dealership parking lot or, you know, on the dealership floor or maybe in a museum or even at a car show, you're not going to get to really see them in action. And I think that, you know, something like this M1 Concourse, and I know there's a famous one in New York somewhere that I'll have to look up, but I know there are others all around the U.S. So this is kind of an interesting thing, and I think that we need to kind of jump on top of it and talk about it if we can.
Yeah.
Sometime soon, anyway. Okay, last little bit of information before we really dig into this list, and I hope this is of interest to you guys because we have been talking about top speed in vehicles for a long time, you know, since we started the show, and we've done several different measures of that speed. We've done the Texas mile where we talk about how fast a car can go in 1 mile a distance, not necessarily a certain speed, within a certain marked mile. Mm-hmm. It's 1 mile. That's it. I mean, I don't know how better to describe that than that. I mean, the Texas Mile episode, if you haven't heard it, please listen to it because it's a unique test. Then there's, you know, the outright speed records that we've talked about. We've talked about the fastest cars for a certain dollar amount and that kind of thing.
Yeah, some other tests, 0 to 60 to 0 and how those are done.
Yeah, exactly. Well, just this week in Sweden, the week we're recording this, I should say, on September 23rd of 2019, a new record was broken. And it was broken by the Koenigsegg Regera, which is different because formerly they have used the Egera, spelled with an A at the beginning instead of the R at the beginning. So this is the Regera. The Regera has set a brand new record, and the record is 1.8 seconds faster than the last time. So they're sometimes breaking their own record. I think that's what they're doing at this point. But the new record for, get this, 0 to 249 miles per hour and then back to zero is 31.49 seconds, which I think is pretty good, pretty solid time. I mean, that's really fast. That's really moving and braking. That's really braking. So that's a quick speed. I know that it takes a lot to do something like that, but I mean, to run up to 250 miles an hour and then back down to zero, 249, I think the—
Why not 250?
Well, I think they actually did break 250 during one run, just to say they did it, but it took 32.48 seconds, so a little bit longer. But the reason is because, of course, over in Sweden, they use the metric system. And so what they were shooting for was 400 kilometers per hour.
Gotcha.
So the actual record is zero to 400 kilometers per hour to zero.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of take that into account
as
well.
That makes
sense. Yeah. So anyways, the Koenigsegg Regera is the brand new holder of that record. And I mean brand new. So look to see that broken probably in the very near future, because I think they're always continually breaking these records. I mean, just one after the other. And we've seen that even within the time frame of when we started this program. We've seen, you know, just— it seems like everybody just has to outdo each other by just a fraction of a second or, you know, whatever it is. And it's always going to be that way. There's always that competition.
It's almost like there's a schedule that we don't know about where they say, we're going to break the record on this day.
It
and
is.
You can come out and get press next week, and then next month will be another cars month.
You know, I think that's what it's all about, right? I think a lot of this is just about press. Is about getting your name and keeping your name out in front of the public for a while.
Yeah.
How much of this do you think, just kind of off the cuff discussion here, but I mean, how much of this do you think is sandbagging? How much do you think that, like, they could have gone— do you think they could have gone faster, or do you think that they're holding back in order to wait until someone breaks this record and then do it again?
Yeah, they may be doing some of that. A lot of times they have the technology to go faster, even if it's not tested yet. Mm-hmm. They know when they're going to test it, and then they know when they're going to beat their own record or someone else's record, who, whatever it is at the time.
Sure, but it's a little counterintuitive to the rest of us, isn't it, though, to think, like, why would they hold back? Why wouldn't they just, if they can, and I'm not saying that Koenigsegg is doing this. I want to make that clear. But why would, let's say that they were, mm-hmm. why do you think that Koenigsegg would ever hold back? I mean, the rest of us would think, like, I'm just going to go as fast as I can. If I break this record by 25 miles per hour, great for me, you know, and let somebody else try to beat me by 1 mile per hour or 25 miles per hour faster than that. I wonder if it's just like we're getting to that point where...
It's such fine-tuned, these records.
Yeah. Now, see, okay, you know, here's one, and I have a very loose example of this, but I don't know even how to put this or the numbers exactly, but think about like championship sprinters, you know, doing the 100-meter dash or, you know, whatever the race is. Think about when, what's that guy's name, Usain Bolt?
Yeah.
He came in and just shattered records. I mean, just blew them away. But up until that point, everybody was breaking records by just little tiny, I mean, just incremental points. And then he just came in and just blew it away. And I think that there's always going to be someone that comes in and does that. I think there's someone that comes in and just destroys any kind of preconceived notion that you have about speed or about time or about whatever. I mean, I think that someone will just... I think someone's going to obliterate this record in the next decade.
Maybe someone with some proprietary technology or something like that.
Yeah, maybe it might take 10 years for someone to come along that does that, and, you know, of these little tiny incremental speed increases. But then someone, I think, you know, comes in 10 years later and just destroys it, you know, with something that, you know, they've been working on for 10 years, you know, trying to get to that point.
Costs could come into play, too. They might not want to take their car out to attempt a record until they have a pretty good idea that they're going to succeed, I think. Like, if every mark is hit, they know exactly what time they're going to get. Maybe they just don't want to go through the whole... It's not like they take the car to the track and say, let's try to do this. Mm-hmm. I think they have already done the testing to know what they're going to do. They just take it to the track to measure it.
They just don't want to take their $4 million baby out there.
Yeah, and, so maybe they don't want to take... Yeah, they don't want to take the technology that's a year or two down the road out there.
So you're saying keep it a little close to the vest.
No, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
Well, they already make the cars look all kinds of weird ways when they take them out there.
Sure,
paint them a certain way and optical illusion.
Oh, the camera. Yeah, I know what you mean, the camouflage cars.
Yeah,
we see a lot of that in... well, we saw a lot of that in Detroit, and there still is a lot of that happening around there. And it's not all that unusual to see a car that has either, you know, the whole body painted that way or decaled that way or whatever it is now.
Yeah.
Probably wrap. But it's a strange auto environment. It really is. I mean, you see some interesting things, but you also see some things that really make you think, like, what do they do that for? You know, what's that all about? Let's get into some of these least likely and weird and unusual race cars in just a moment right after the break. And we're back, and you're listening to The Fast Track, and I'm one of your hosts, Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Kurt Guerin.
Oh, Kurt, you're right on top of things today.
Flew right in there.
Yeah, I'm impressed. Very good. All right, so I think we've already kind of introed this. You know, there's these unusual cars out there, right? I mean, as the author of this article says, his name is Benjamin Hunting. He's a writer from a site called drivingline.com, and that's the list that we're going to follow. As Benjamin says, you know, racing gets weird sometimes. It really does get unusual and strange, and... we all know this. We all know that racers in a particular series, whatever series it may be, are all about bending the rules. And especially, we've seen this especially in NASCAR, right?
Yeah.
We've seen it so many times in NASCAR with so many different colorful characters and people that, you know, just right in your face about it, too. You know, like if it's not specifically exactly in the rule book like that, I'm going to do it. And then, you know, the next race has changed. You know, it's the rules in the rule book, and now you can't do that. So they have to change their tactic. And it's kind of this this cat and mouse back and forth, you know, play the game type thing that they do. And as fans, we love to watch this, right? We love to see the, you know, the characters that are like a Smokey Unick or Carroll Shelby or any of those guys, you know, that were really just exciting to watch. AJ Foyt, whoever it happens to be, you know, it's just it creates characters.
Sure does.
And, you know, larger than life characters at the racetrack. One of the things that results from this is unusual car design or car technology or just tactics or, you know, whatever it happens to be. But these happen to be the whole deal, like the complete package. These are unusual cars. Some of them do have just unusual technology, but along with that, form has to follow the function, right? So this makes the vehicle look weird because they're trying this new technology. It makes it look unusual on the track, and that's what makes it stand out. And sometimes these are the cars that get all the attention whether or not they're on the pole position or win the race or don't even place at all, if they make one lap, everybody's kind of, you know, oohing and aahing over that one car or, you know, laughing at it. Maybe they're laughing at it. That's the other thing.
A modern example of some of these types of cars would be the Delta Wing.
Oh, yeah.
It was an IMSA sports car.
Yeah.
I don't think they're racing it anymore.
Very unusual
so
car.
So that kind of gives you an idea, if you're familiar with the Delta Wing, what we're about to dive into.
Yeah, if you're not, take a look online. That is a really strange design. But that's exactly what we're talking about. And as Benjamin says here, you know, that defy convention and in a lot of cases, the boundaries of good taste. And I agree, sometimes that's the case. But, you know, they all have something likable about them as well. You know, there's something about rooting for the underdog or something about, you know, cheering for the guy that is trying something new. Hey, why not? And they do so behind the wheel of misfits. And that's the way it is with our number one car on the list here, Kurt. It is the Cadillac Le Monstre. And I believe this is a French car, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so French car. It's a 1949 car, which is competing in 1950. And I'll describe what's going on here. But you really need to take a look at this car online. You need to have an image of what we're talking about here because there is some unusual bodywork going on, right?
Definitely.
It's a very unusual looking car to me. You know what it looks like to me? And I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, believe it or not. I mean, I kind of grew up in that era. And I think that was the first movie I ever saw, like out, you know, with my parents, like at a theater, Star Wars. But doesn't it look a lot like is it the Land Speeder or is that the thing I'm thinking of?
I'm not a big Star Wars fan either.
To me, the Cadillac Series 61 that this is built from or based on, this 1949, not the streetcar, but this car, this Le Monstre, looks an awful lot like the Land Speeder. And it looks like it's almost hovering above the ground. You can't really see the wheels underneath it. It's such an unusual design.
Funny.
It's very, very strange. Very cool now. But imagine seeing this in 1950 on the racetrack in Le Mans, because that's where it raced. Briggs Cunningham was the one who took this car. And again, underneath, it's a 1949 Cadillac Series 61. There's a couple of cars that he actually brought. He brought a factory spec, manual equipped Series 61 coupe. And the other one was this one that they had designed in the wind tunnel. And this is the Le Monstre. Which means, of course, the monster, and for good reason. I mean, when you see it, I guess. but this car had a 331 cubic inch V8 that had five carburetors, and it says it ran an eventful race, burying itself in the sandbank at one point and requiring Cunningham to leave the driver's seat and dig it out. And then despite all of that, he finished 11th in the race. Now, isn't that unusual? I mean, and now think about getting out of the car, having to dig it out of a sandbank, get it back on the course, getting back in, racing again, you know, for the remainder of the 24 hours, whatever it is, and still finishing in 11th place.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
It is impressive. Yeah, it's impressive that the car survived that kind of a lick.
Yeah, I think it's a decent finish, I guess, for a vehicle, you know, that did something like that. Usually, you know, we've heard of these unusual cases where a driver will be in a race and they'll, you know, they call it spin and win. So they've had a spin out, they didn't hit a wall or anything like that, and yet they win the race somehow.
Yeah.
It's very unusual. It happens, but it's very unusual. But this is and not quite the same. I mean, finished 11th place, but that's a long race, and digging out of the sand, that's something that you don't see anybody do, you know, and still win the race by any means.
So. Doesn't look like it would take much to get this thing stuck in the sand, though.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I do have a little bit of an update on this one. But as of 2017, and I have a feeling these have moved, but as of 2017, or at least in 2017, the car was on display at a place called the Revs Institute in Naples, Florida, along with a collection of other Cadillac race cars from the 2017 wins at both the Rolex 24 in Daytona and the 12 Hours of Sebring, and the title wins that they won for those seasons as well. So this is a group, it was within a group of other Cadillac race cars from the modern era, which I would have loved to have seen this in Naples, Florida. That's not too far of a drive from us here in Atlanta. The second car on our list, Kurt, is the Chaparral 2J, and this one is from around 1970. And I do want to tell you that we have already done the full Chaparral story on Car Stuff a long time ago. We did this back in 2011. So if you want to get some info on that and about, you know, that whole thing and a lot about the Can-Am series and, you know, the cars that competed in that, you can, you know, check that out if you want to. So the idea behind the Chaparral 2J was that they were going to use something called Active Aero. Active Aero had a different meaning back then. A little bit of a different meaning back then than it does now. Now what we typically see are movable wings that adjust at speed and kind of change the airflow over the vehicle in order to produce more downforce at, you know, when it's necessary and where it's necessary. This one, however, was able to generate, this is the crazy thing, able to generate something like 1.5 Gs of downforce regardless of whatever speed it was traveling. So the car, you have to imagine this. So let's say that the car is sitting still on a scale and it weighs, let's say, 1,000 pounds, just an easy round number to deal with. We flip on this giant fan that's in the back of the car that's run by a 2-stroke motor. And what it does is it sucks all the air out from underneath the car and pulls it down to the road surface, right? It's driving it straight down, not any direction, just straight down. The engine is doing nothing but pulling, and the fan is pulling the air out, pulling it down.
It's like a vacuum.
Exactly right. So you flip the switch and this thing starts up and the vacuum starts up. And suddenly the scale will read, or it will appear that the car weighs 1,500 pounds. Mm-hmm. And that's a crude way to put that. And I don't even know if that's true or not. But what I'm saying is it will pull down with the amount of force equal to 1.5 its own weight, like 1.5 times its own weight as it travels down the track. Now, I mean, again, it could be sitting still and do the same thing. That's why I use that example. But that's probably a terrible way to put that. I hope an engineer doesn't call in and say, that's completely wrong. You screwed everything up. I'm backpedaling a little bit because I'm terrible at this type of thing. But that's my understanding of it anyway, is that the car effectively, as it travels down, that's the goal, right, is to make it heavier. Like as you go faster, yeah, it pushes down on the tires more than it does when it's sitting still. And this car, no matter what speed you're going, it's pushing down on the tires with like 1.5 times its own weight, mm-hmm, which is crazy to think about. I mean, yeah. And so imagine the advantage that a driver has when they're driving this car through a corner. I mean, it's almost as if you could take away, not that you can completely take away, but you could almost imagine a driver with less skill being able to corner harder than a driver with a lot of skill, because the faster you go, the more this thing creates downforce. I mean, mm-hmm, it's a ridiculous amount of downforce in this car. There's another kind of related car that I want to talk about. In 1978, there was the Brabham BT46B, which is called the fan car, and it was designed by a guy named Gordon Murray. It would use kind of like a similar downforce principle. This one was powered by the car's engine itself. So the faster the car went, the more downforce it would create. Mm-hmm. So again, this one even more than the other one, I would guess, that suction effect, you know, around the corners was just unreal. I mean, you're able to corner inside, outside, you know, right down the perfect line, wherever you want to. Everybody else would have problems. You wouldn't have any problems at all. So one thing interesting I thought was the lead driver for the car during that era for Brabham was Niki Lauda. He was the Austrian driver at the time. And, of course, there's also another Brazilian driver, you know, another co-driver, and that was Nelson Piquet. So they both got some time behind the wheel, a couple of big names in F1 and worth mentioning anyway. Number three on the list, you know, this is one that I bet a lot of people do kind of laugh at, but this is the Lada Granta. I hope I'm saying that right, the Lada Granta. Now, I know I'm getting the Lada part right, but I hope the Granta is right, or East Granta. Maybe it's Granta. I don't know. The Lada is not necessarily the best car. It's a Russian brand of car, and you know, they make a lot of street cars in Europe. They make a ton of them, actually. They make, gosh, I want to say it's in the millions. I mean, they've been making them since 2011. I think they're still making them, but it's built in Russia, in Ukraine, Egypt, and even in Kazakhstan is where this thing is built. Of course, they're going to take one of their cars to compete in the World Touring Car Championship. Of course, why not? Why wouldn't they, right? But they chose the Lada Granta, which is an unusual choice. It first competed in 2012, and it has a different engine. It has a turbocharged 4-cylinder engine, and it has 380 horsepower. That is not the Lada Granta that you're going to get if you buy it out of the dealership. You're going to get a 1.6-liter 8-valve inline-4 engine, or possibly, if you upgraded, you can get a 16-valve inline-4 as well. Now, one thing I do need to mention this. I think we probably should talk about this just for a second, is that the World Touring Car Championship actually folded in 2017, so it no longer exists. It started in 1987, so this was around for 30 years. It's kind of a big deal. Along the lines of this, while I'm thinking about it, have you ever heard of something called the North American Touring Car Championship?
I have.
You have?
Yeah.
Really? I was very close to this one. I was working for Daimler Chrysler at the time, and I was closely involved with this, knew some of the drivers, got to get to some of the tracks, got to, you know, some press access, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was really, I'll tell you, I'm excited about talking about that one, and I kind of put that into the back of my head for a long time. And so maybe we should talk about that series
at
some point.
Yeah,
let's do it. But I think that, you know, what goes along with that is the World Touring Car Championship, and let's definitely get into those two as well.
Sure.
All right. So number four on the list is the Citroen ID19. And okay, before we start even talking about where this one appeared, because this one has some history, we did do a couple of Car Stuff episodes on this one, too. If you want the entire Citroen story, part one and part two, it was done in November of 2014. It's got an extensive history on the whole thing. But this is maybe one of the craziest ones on the list for me.
Really?
What do you think? Do you agree?
There's some little nuance that makes it not as crazy to me, in my opinion.
Okay, all right. Yeah, to me, this is one of the more fascinating ones just because of how this would be even possible today. And I don't think it wouldn't be possible, obviously. The Citroen ID19, if you don't know what that is a, it's part of the D series of cars. The ID meant that simply that it had a manual transmission and a cloth interior, and the DS had leather seats and something called a Citromatic transmission. So it was an automatic, but it had a shift lever, but no clutch. So the ID and the DS are kind of along the same appearance, but different trim packages and things like that and options. And between 1955 and 1975, well, they built 1.4 million of these cars. So a lot of them were out there. However, early on in the run of these cars, again, they started in 1955. In 1958, in Riverside, California, an ID19, or actually a pair of ID19s, ran in a NASCAR race.
Yeah.
Do you find that hard to believe?
Somewhat.
A NASCAR race.
It was a road course, though.
Yeah,
that's the thing that makes it a little bit easier to believe, because NASCAR was a bit different back then.
It was a lot different back then, apparently. I mean, if you know what a Citroen ID19 looks like, from 1958, take a look at one online if you don't, and imagine that running in NASCAR. That's really hard to believe on a road course, on an oval, whatever. But this was the old Riverside track, and it ran in 1958 as part of the Crown America 500. Get this. They both finished inside the top 20. They finished 18th and 19th overall, but that means that in their class, they were first and second place. So a Citroen has won a NASCAR race, yep, with a 70 horsepower engine. That's it. Now look at what they're running today, and the horsepower and the appearance of them, and how closely they're matched, how they look. This, they look essentially the same. Essentially, mm-hmm. I mean, I know there's variation between manufacturers, but it's such an unusual thing. I hadn't put this together, but the author did. They used it kind of as a punchline in the
Talladega Nights.
Yeah, Talladega Nights. Yep. That's the one. The Legend of Ricky Bobby, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they used it as kind of a punchline because the challenger is the French guy, right? He's the Perrier driver.
Yeah.
Sacha Baron Cohen, is that who it was? Yeah,
that was
very
actor.
Funny. So it's kind of a funny thing, but yeah, I hadn't you put that together, those two things together, until this point, but I think that's really funny.
That's clever, yeah.
Also, we're going to go on to number five here in just a minute, but I want to make sure that you do something for me in the future. I want you to hold me to this. I find that I'm not as drawn to NASCAR stuff as I probably should be.
Mm-hmm.
I just haven't had as much of an interest in it as I have in open wheel and that type of thing. So I want to make sure that we equally cover all these different series. And I'd like to cover NASCAR because I think there's a lot there. There's a lot of stories there, of course.
Sure.
There's a lot of technology that I don't want to ignore. Mm-hmm. It's just not my favorite series right now. I mean, I'm growing to love it over the years. I should say growing to like it. I still don't love it yet, but maybe I could be convinced along the way.
Yeah.
I used to call it NASCrap. I'll admit to that. I still do with my dad just to be fun because he likes NASCAR, and it's just a little father son ribbing that goes on,
yeah,
a little joke, But so yeah, we will talk about some NASCAR stuff in upcoming shows, I promise. The series, the drivers, some of the oddities. There's plenty of those oddities out there. And all right, number five here on the list is this is an unusual one, but I bet it's one that most people can picture in their mind. At least most of our listeners can picture in their mind, I would think. This is the Volvo 850 wagon that was in the British Touring Car Championship.
Mm-hmm. This one, to me, is iconic.
Oh, I completely agree. And how it came about is really, really unusual. There's a long, long story that I'm not going to bore you with, but it raced in the 1994 season of the British Touring Car Championship. And again, there's a fascinating story behind why it raced in there. And I can give you just the highlights right now. But again, I bet that most of our listeners can picture this in their mind.
Yeah.
Just close your eyes, and if you're not driving, close your eyes, imagine what this car looks like. And typically, you'll think of this car going around a corner on two wheels, and that's what the photographers just loved about this car, is that it was always on two wheels. But it had some other advantages, or maybe it wasn't advantages, it was just it didn't have the disadvantages that you would think that it would have. This was a car that actually performed just as well as the 850 sedan did. Yeah. And they didn't really know that until there was a shortage at the factory. So here's how all this goes down. So Volvo hadn't raced since about 1986 when it was in something called the European Touring Car Cup, which was called the ETCC, and that went defunct. And then in the early 1990s, Volvo's senior vice president decided that it was time to return to racing and to pep up the brand that was at this point better known for safety. You know, they had all these safety innovations. Yeah. They still do. I mean, they're still a brand known for safety, which is not a bad thing. That's a really good thing. But they wanted to kind of, you know, I don't know, spice it up a little bit, right? I mean, it's time to, you know, get back on the racetrack and show what we can do as well. And so a Swedish performance company was chosen. It was called Stephenson Automotive, or Stefansson Automotive. I hope I'm not pronouncing that totally wrong, but SAM is how they do the acronym for that. The story is they went to the factory to pick up the cars that they were supposed to pick up. And there's a shortage of the 850 sedan bodies at the time. They were supposed to go to customers, or, you know, they just simply didn't have them. They weren't building them fast enough to be able to provide them or the racing effort. And the only bodies that were available were the wagons. And they decided, let's take the wagons. Let's just do it. We've got an assignment. We have a short amount of time to build these race cars. We're going to take these wagons. We're going to do it. You know, it's going to be unusual.
One of the best ideas ever.
So they find out that, as it turns out, there's no disadvantage to running the wagon versus the sedan aerodynamically. It's really a cool-looking vehicle. If you're a wagon fan, you fall in love with this immediately. I did. I'm a huge wagon fan anyway.
Yeah, sad. Sad that there are no, you don't find wagons anymore.
Yeah,
no one's making them.
It's hard to. There's a few out there, and I've been seeing them in commercials recently. Mm-hmm. This particular vehicle was probably photographed more than any other car in the series during that season, which was just a boon for
Volvo.
For Volvo, yeah. I mean, it was an unbelievable stroke of genius on their part, and they didn't even know it was really going to happen. Like, the company didn't know it. The company that was building them, the Stephenson Automotive, the performance company, they didn't know what was going to happen either. They figured they were going to be ridiculed, and I think initially they were. They were kind of laughed at, but they actually...
It's a happy accident.
Yeah, they... I think that they said that the best that they finished was something like 14th and 15th in that one season. It's a cool-looking car. If you haven't ever seen it, you know, look it up. The Volvo 850 wagon from the British Touring Car Championship, or BTCC. And you know what? We're going to have the rest of our list in just a moment after the break. And we're back, and you're listening to The Fast Track, and I'm your host, Scott Benjamin.
And I am Kurt Guerin.
Kurt's holding in there for number six. All right, this one... That's an unusual one, too. These are all unusual. That's why they're on the list, isn't it? This is the Mercedes-Benz 300 SEL AMG. Now, a couple of things make this really unique. Now, this one, for one, it's a limousine. It's crazy. I mean, if you look at it, it doesn't look like it should be on the racetrack.
It doesn't.
But I think the more that I see this one, the more it grows on me. I initially didn't necessarily like it. It's a fire engine red AMG sedan. I guess a limousine. It's a longer version of the car anyway, which is really weird. This one raced in the 24-hour race at Spa in 1971, and this is the first race car that was ever built by AMG.
Yeah,
which when you look back, I mean, you see a ton of Mercedes on the roads right now that have the AMG tag on it. Mm-hmm. A lot of AMG cars. AMG has been around for 52 years now. They've been around since 1967, and this was the first race car that they ever created. Now, I know that they were working on other things, you know, for Mercedes-Benz at the time. It's kind of their performance division, if you want to call it that, or the performance house. But it is a full-size sedan. I've seen it called limo some places, but full-size sedan is probably a better way to say it. The car actually won its class and was second overall in the race that it was in. We're talking about, again, the Spa 24-hour race in 1971. Huge horsepower, 428 horsepower, 448 pound-feet of torque, and that comes from an engine. I want to say that this was a bored-out version of the already giant V8 that they had under the hood, which was either, I can't determine this, it was either a 6.3-liter engine or a 6.6-liter engine that they then bored out to be 6.8 liters. But it has some unusual things. It has it has a wood dash. It's kind of like a sleeper car, I guess, if you want to put it that way. You know, I mean, it doesn't look like, outside of the decals, if it didn't have all that, I mean, it's a little bit jacked up in the rear. It's got, you know, rally lights in the front. If you took all that off of there, the decals, the lights, it would just look like a sedan on the road. It really wouldn't be anything, you know, much different. I mean, the tires are a little bit wider. Sure, I get it. But I don't know. It's just like taking whatever car you had on the street and throwing it on the racetrack and you know, putting a number on it and calling it a race car.
Yeah, but it still has the chrome trim on it. Doesn't look like a race car. It doesn't look like it would be very fast either.
They called it the Red Pig. I mean, if that says anything. So it's the Mercedes-Benz 300 SEL AMG, or if you want to search the Red Pig, you'll find an image or a photo of this car. Now, so here's what happened to the original car, because a lot of people are wondering, you know, where is it? Is it a museum somewhere or something like that? That's unfortunately not the case. That didn't happen. It had a tragic end, and replicas of the original are available. They're, you know, you get, of course, they're at museums and, you know, people are building them, that kind of thing. And they're exact replicas. They're very detailed, right down to, you know, exactly the way it was. But the original was sold to an aircraft company, and because it was one of the fastest cars in the world at the time, you know, from one of the fastest, it was huge horsepower again. It was perfect, as they say, for testing landing gear at speed by dropping the landing gear through holes that they cut into the floorboards of the car.
No.
So they would drive this thing down the track at speed and then drop the landing gear through these holes, which would just tear the hell out of the car. I mean, every time they did it, right? Unfortunately, it didn't take very long, but this thing eventually just became such a total wreck that they couldn't even use it for that. So the original Red Pig met quite a strange end. I don't think there's a lot of cars that have a history like that, or, you know, an end like that, especially race cars. Usually they either crash or they end up in a museum.
Yeah.
You know, one of the two.
Yeah.
Next one on the list, this is number 7. It's the Toyota Prius GT. Might laugh throwing a GT at the end of Prius, but until you see the Prius GT, you don't understand. I mean, this is the Super GT Prius, which debuted in the Super GT series in 2012. It took the class pole position in the GT 300 class and then took sixth place at the 2012 Fuji GT 500-kilometer race. It is, as you may have already guessed, not your typical Toyota Prius. Still a hybrid. It still has a larger lithium-ion battery, as you might expect. But the biggest difference is that it has a mid-mounted 3.4-liter V8 engine that produces 300 horsepower. Of course, it's naturally aspirated. It's not a turbo engine. It ran from about 2012 until 2018, and it got the podium several times during that time. This one, I have been staring at photos of this for a long time, trying to figure out where the Prius is underneath there, because it doesn't have a whole lot of shared panels or anything like that. I mean, it's buried somewhere underneath some really impressive-looking bodywork. Just real quick, this is something that comes back to the Roadkill Nights. Mm-hmm. I was watching a little bit of the Roadkill Nights footage, you know, some of the drag events. And one of the things that they had paired up was a Dodge Dart Demon and a Prius. And you might think, okay, well, what are they doing with this? Well, the Prius was actually powered by a Dodge Hellcat crate engine. And not just the Hellcat engine, because you might think, well, maybe the Dart Demon still has a chance against this lightweight Prius, right? But they had upgraded the 707-horsepower Hellcat engine by adding a 4.5-liter Whipple supercharger to that. So it's achieving 1,000 horsepower in a Prius.
That just falls into that Y category.
Yeah, so this is not this is not for fuel economy or anything like that, right? But it's funny as hell to watch this Prius drag. And, it destroys the Dodge Demon right off the line. I mean, it's within 10 feet you're going to see who's going to win. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that quick. It's like it's just gone. Let's speed through these last couple so that we can get to our extras, okay? So there's the 1976 Tyrrell P34. Actually, this is called the Project 34. Consider this the most unusual F1 car you've probably ever seen. That's the way I'm going to say it. This is the six-wheeler. And I think a lot of people can also picture this one in their mind. This is the six-wheeler that has, I think it has Elf printed on the side. A lot of people can picture that as well. Mm. I think Elf was like a fuel or something at the time, wasn't it?
I think so.
Something like that.
They were a long time in,
but it was
F1, too.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it was through the 2000s or late 90s.
Yeah. I think of sponsorship, or you'd see banners, or at least, you know, some kind of signage for those. This is a car that was designed by a guy named Derek Gardner, who is actually better known as a transmission designer up until the point that he met Ken Tyrrell in 1970, and he convinced him to start designing cars, and he did so. I think around 1970, they started building cars in God, I think it was just like a private garage. Maybe even, it could have even been Derek Gardner's garage. This one has a V8 engine. It's a Ford Cosworth engine, DFV engine, which stands for double four-valve engine. The reason behind this, and a lot of people will wonder, why bother with extra wheels? You think it would just be extra trouble? And, you know, the advantage comes in increased braking power, which I guess makes sense. You get more braking surface, so you're able to, you know, go harder into the corners when you need to, and that's exactly what they did. And it raced, it was sort of successful. It raced during, I think it was 1976 and 1977, and it retired after 1977. It kind of won over fans. It initially, you know, fans laughed at it, thought it was kind of ridiculous, and it still looks ridiculous a little bit, but it did win people over. It ran in 30 races. It had only one win, which was in the Swedish Grand Prix, and that's when Jody Scheckter drove that car. And then had one pole position, and three times it set the fastest lap in a race. Then there's the number nine, the Rolls-Royce Corniche. Now, we've done a lot of car stuff episodes on Rolls-Royce, and you know all about the luxury and the, you know, the opulence of the Rolls-Royce, and that's not what this one is all about. This is a different animal altogether.
This right? is my weirdest one on the list.
Is it really?
Oh yeah.
Oh, so you like? Do you like this one a lot? Do you
enjoy
this?
It's not that I like it. It's just, yeah, it would be strange seeing it race across the desert.
Yeah, back what was it? The Paris to Dakar rally. This was a 1981 entry to the Paris to Dakar event. And I don't know how many years it raced, but it's not entirely a Rolls-Royce. Underneath, there's a Toyota Land Cruiser chassis. It's powered by a 5.7-liter small-block Chevy V8. They thought it was a joke again, but gosh, I mean, it did pretty well in the standings. I think it was as high as 13 in the mm-hmm. standings. Not too bad, really. And it's a grueling race, a very difficult race to make. And to consider that you're in a Rolls-Royce, I mean, it's a funny idea, isn't it, that, you know, that this is such a luxury car and it's known for its opulence. But here it is blazing across the desert. And I'm sure that inside there, it was uncomfortable. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a comfort trip by any means. It's not like you're in the lap of luxury.
Not like
in one of the
hardly a Rolls Royce.
It's not like in one of the Cannonball Run movies or something where it's, you know, a race car underneath and, you know, it's a race car inside as well. It's got, you know, it has to have all that as well.
Yeah. I love the name too, Jules.
Yeah, Jules.
Do you name your cars, Scott?
I do not. Have you ever named a car?
They kind of develop names over time.
Let me ask you this. Does your current car have a name?
It does, yeah.
Jane. Okay, Jane.
Yeah.
Is that right?
We're playing Jane. Then I've had the Silver Bullet was my first car.
Mm-hmm. That's funny because
four-cylinder Honda Civic hatchback.
Okay.
Silver Bullet.
That's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I would bet a lot of people, I just never even think about this, but I would bet a lot of people name their car.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear some people, you know, some of our listeners write in with the names of their car or cars that they've had in the past and what type of car it was and maybe even, you know, short description why. Number 10, you know, I'm going to do something unusual here. I'm going to actually change the order up of our show here right as we're talking.
Oh, curveball.
Just a little bit. Not too much. Because number 10 relates to what I'm going to talk about later.
Okay.
So I do want to bring out one that I did not find on the list that I think was really unusual. In 1950, hey, again with 1950, oh, 1958 was the Citroen. 1950, in the Poor Man's 500, which I think is a great name for a NASCAR race. It's so funny. The Poor Man's 500 at Canfield Speedway in Ohio. A Tucker participated in a NASCAR race. It's believed to be car number 1023. The photos appeared in Hemmings. I think it started somewhere around 2008 when they kind of, you know, posed the idea that, you know, this might have happened and here's a photo of a car that looks like a NASCAR. Did this really happen? And, you know, there's a lot of discussion and back and forth. And then eventually the son of the man that ran the car in the NASCAR race rode in with another photograph of his dad standing next to the same car on the same car lot. So proof positive that, you know, he definitely did run this thing. The photo was taken in the Mount Oliver section of Pittsburgh. I think it's a used car dealer lot that it's on, of all things. I mean, and I'll tell you about car number 1023. This is unusual. This is one that was actually lost in a fire later on, and then it was buried under the garage of the Tucker Automobile Club of America's founder in Florida. So if you want to know where it is, it's underneath a slab of concrete in Florida. But an unusual thing. And if you go to Hemmings.com, you can see photographs of the NASCAR Tucker. It's got the number 12 painted on the side there, and it looks like Joe Nagel Jr. Motor Sales is the name printed on the side. So thought that was interesting. The driver's name was Joe Marola, and he was out of Braddock, Pennsylvania. All right, so number 10 on this list is Jungle Jim's Chevrolet Vega wagon, a second wagon to make the list, and I see why. This one is a drag car. You know drag racing. I mean, do we see that kind of thing now?
I don't see it anymore.
Maybe.
I'm not sure how common it was back then. I mean, I know in the late 60s and 70s, like, you wanted your car to look...
You try to be outrageous.
Exaggerated and weird and...
You gotta be a little crazy, right? You gotta be a little outrageous, a little different, a little unique. All right, well, that's coming up in just a second, too, so hang on.
Okay.
So the thing is that wagons actually had a kind of a surge of interest, as they say, in the NHRA Pro Stock class because of the mass at the back of the wagon, which actually added to the traction of the vehicle. So think about going back to that Volvo 850 wagon in the Touring Car Championship. Mm-hmm. Similar idea. You know, there's
probably a lot of the same reasons.
There's a bit of advantage. I mean, and once you're at speed, again, there's a little bit of an aerodynamic advantage as well. So one of the craziest cars that was out there was Jungle Jim Lieberman, and he raced in a 1972 Chevy Vega wagon. And of all things, the Chevy Vega. A lot of people, you know, laugh at the Chevy Vega because it was supposed to be more about economy than it was about performance, of course. And, you know, it doesn't matter in NHRA Pro Stock. You just throw an engine. It's just a shell at that point, really. I mean, there's nothing underneath it that is stock, really. It had a short wheelbase because it was a compact wagon. It had a lightweight design, you know, but weighted in the right way. You know, it was weighted exactly where he needed it. So, you know, it was actually a strong performer. And Jungle Jim was, he was one of the early guys that was like really, I would call him flamboyant, but I don't mean that. I mean, he was more like a promoter, like a showman. He ended up dying fairly young. He died at the age of 31. He was killed in a Corvette, and I think he was in Pennsylvania, I believe, at the time. He went around a corner too fast and head on with a bus. Of all things, he hit a bus head on. I mean, that's what you hear about, like he could get hit by a bus.
Yeah.
Who knows? But he was only 31 years old, made quite an impression on everybody. But I said that he was kind of a showman, right?
Right.
All right. So I have, I'm telling you what I'm doing here. I'm going to slide a piece of paper over to you. And I have stapled a piece of white paper on top of this. So Kurt has never seen what I'm about to show him. He might already know. He kind of has a knowing look. But to go along with the Jungle Jim story, we have to include one other character that Jungle Jim had with him on the track.
Can I guess, or do you want me to look first?
Do you want to guess?
I want to guess.
Okay.
Is it his wife?
It's his girlfriend.
Yeah, girlfriend. Okay.
His girlfriend.
Yeah.
Her name?
I don't know her name.
Oh, her name was Jungle Pam. Jungle Pam. Okay, so I'm... Jungle Pam Hardy. Now, Jungle Pam Hardy.
Yep, there she is.
I'm showing him some photos of Jungle Pam Hardy and what Jungle Pam Hardy's job was on the track. Now, she was something that they call a staging girl. And I'm not trying to be derogatory in any means, and I'm going to try to be very careful about this. I am. But she was a rather busty person, buxom. Mm-hmm.
Good-looking lady.
She was a good-looking lady, yeah. But it was his girlfriend. I think he just met her like cruising by her one day on the sidewalk or some story like that. They were boyfriend and girlfriend. She toured with him for a while. She would come out in these extremely skimpy outfits. I'll call them a uniform, but it was an outfit. Go-go boots, you know, really tiny little shorts and a halter top. And you got to remember the era. She would come out and in these outfits, drive the guys, you know, at the track crazy. And, you know, her job was to back him up, you know, once he had done his burnout. And she would also, she would very seductively bend over and check for fluid leaks under the car and add fluids and, you know, make sure that, do final checks, right? She actually was the one who packed his parachutes. She would do more than you knew behind the scenes. She was hands-on. Mm-hmm. She really was. And not a lot of people knew that she was hands-on in the pit area. She was definitely like a pinup type girl, you know, that they loved to photograph her. Jungle Jim knew that, and that's why she was there exactly. And other teams copied that. They brought someone like that with them as well because Jim was stealing all the attention from every other driver. No matter how he did in the race, no matter how poorly he was performing, everybody was looking at his team and his name was getting out there because of Jungle Pam. So he knew how valuable Pam was, not only for, you know, because she was actually helping on the team, but also the promotional aspects of this whole thing. I want to tell you something that I found pretty unusual. Going through and finding these Jungle Pam images and kind of learning about her, and there's kind of a resurgence of that right now happening, and it's kind of a popular thing
at local
racetracks.
Sure.
I didn't know that. I'm not one to hang out at the racetracks. Maybe you've seen this in person.
Yeah, I feel like it was, even back then, it was just kind of part of the show, even when it was a street racing type thing back in the 50s. I can only imagine, but the women also played that part in the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, I've seen Grease before.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, but you know what? Here's the thing, and I'm not just talking about, you know, the rockabilly looking girl that throws the green flag, yeah. You know, jumps up and down, you know, wearing shorts or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about like a full on backup girl at a drag racing competition, just like Pam Hardy was, that has other duties, but, you know, dresses in go-go boots, dresses like they're in the late 60s. They have that look intentionally. If you want to get an idea of what I'm talking about, you can look up articles about the backup girl or the comeback of the backup girl, or there's a video online called Southeast Gassers Backup Girls 2017 season. It's a brand new version. You'll see, women from this year that are doing this. I mean, and before you write in hostile letters or whatever, these are women of all ages, sizes, shapes, different styles of dress. I mean, it's girlfriends, it's wives, it's daughters, it's anyone really that wants to do this. And it looks like a lot of fun. It really does. It seems like, you know, those rockabilly events where they have, you know, rat rods and things like that and music. And it looks like the women that are participating in that as well that are doing this. It's just that similar kind of feel. It's kind of a neat nostalgic thing that's taking grip. And I kind of like it. I like the trend. It gives you that feel, that old-time feel when you see it, even if it's modern
something
day.
Something about the cars back then, too. Just they were more wild and out of control. Well, you can hear the... You know, the supercharger whining and everything.
Well,
and
that's the thing.
The fuel was coming out. And
yeah.
It was just, to me, the cars of that era and the whole spectacle of it is just more raw. And
well, you shared with me a video recently of, it was a drag racing documentary, I guess we'll call it.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was called, but it was from the late 60s in Indianapolis at the national event. And oh, my gosh. I think it was a Hearst-sponsored thing because Hearst appeared everywhere
in that video a few times.
But it was film, obviously. It was, you know, the old film, and it had that alone gives it a great texture or feel.
Mm-hmm.
But the cars and the people and the dress and the way it's narrated, just everything about that piece was unbelievable. It was really, really cool. I loved watching that. And, you know, the music, it's original music that was scored, you know, just for that documentary, very much of the era, very much of the late 60s, early 70s. I think it was late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you're right, the raw power of those cars. I mean, a lot of them are, you know, if they screw up, it's in a wheel stand, and, you know, that's, or a lot of them were drifting over into the other lane and bumping the other car. And
engine was just right there in front of them, and it would be losing parts as it flew down the track.
Beautiful cars. I mean, it's just unreal. It's so cool to watch that old stuff. But I tell you, Kurt, I think we've had a lot of topics just from this one list that I think are going to kind of be spinoffs that we're going to do for future shows. So look for that for sure. And in the meantime, if you want to check us out on social media, we are on Facebook and Instagram, where we are The Fast Track Show. And you can also go on to Twitter, where we are The Fast Track Pod. And if you want to go to the show's website, where we have an archive of all of our podcasts and, you know, just a little bit of everything that we do, you can go to thefasttrackshow.com, and that's probably one of the better places to do that. Actually, you can go anywhere. You can go to Apple Podcasts, or you can go to the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you listen to podcasts to get them, but they are kind of archived there at thefasttrackshow.com. And if, as we always say, if you like what you're listening to, if you like what you're hearing, make sure you tell your friends, because we're trying to grow our audience, and it's one of the best ways to do that by, you know, getting a recommendation from you. If you've already heard us and you like it, just let your friends know and say, you know, you might want to give these guys a shot. So with that, we'll bid you adieu and see you next week.
Thanks.
The Fast Track is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.